Greetings, I'm Earl Fontenelle, and you are listening to the Schwepp Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast online at schwepp.net. Oddcast episode, Astral Weeks, on the Planetary Order in the West. Well, gentle listener, let's have a quick review of where we are in terms of all things astrological. In episode 10 of the podcast, Prayer to the Gods of Night, the Near Eastern Roots of Astrology, the Schwepp had a look at the Sumero-Akkadian civilizations of the Near East, from the Bronze Age down to the Hellenistic period, and talked about a few of the crucial contributions those peoples made to what would eventually become Western cosmology. Notably, the advances they made in stellar observation and mathematical modeling, certain peculiar choices, like assuming that the stars were gods, and that stellar phenomena were messages foretelling what was going to happen to the royal family, ideas which, in the fullness of time, would lead to the birth of astrology as we know it, and that most essential of imports to the West, the zodiac. In episode 40, Wheels Within Wheels Toward Western Esoteric Cosmology, we followed up on that introductory episode, discussing some of the important ancient Greek cosmological premises, which kind of form a backbone to much Western esoteric thinking down to the present day, notably the geocentric cosmos model, which for reasons still not understood became the dominant cosmic model for thousands of years, despite the availability of better options, including a solar system model posited by Aristarchus of Samos in the 3rd century BCE. So you've got geocentrism, and then in episode 41, Fate and Foreknowledge Toward Hellenistic Astrology, we discussed said discipline of astrology proper, one of the most important Western systems for organizing human life and thought ever developed, arguably on par with other big names like Abrahamic religion and scientific rationality, as a generator of meaning and a way of conceiving, among other things, time. And time is the subject of this episode. Indeed, if we wanted to look at the sort of deep structures of Western esoteric thought in a general way, and I'm not suggesting we do that with great seriousness, because these general way deep structure approaches always miss out details, but we can certainly do it playfully, keeping in mind that generalizations are usually traps of one sort or another. If we wanted to do that, we might be struck by a certain approach to time, which distinguishes Western esoteric thought, generally speaking, from exoteric thought. Exoteric thought, be it dominant Jewish, Christian, or Islamic thinking from the Middle Ages to the present, or indeed Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment God-is-optional rationalism, this exoteric way of thinking chiefly deals with quantitative time. Time as a kind of non-spatial distance to be measured, clock time. Western esotericism, by way of contrast, has a tendency, generally speaking, to look at time qualitatively, kairos time. Time is the product of the celestial motions, and thus a shifting schema of powers and qualities stemming from the celestial bodies and their conjunctions and so on. Now, I know your dominant Christian mainstream calendar has its holy day, Sunday. It is studded with saints' days, if you're in a more old-school type of Christianity. And there is a sort of sacred macro timeline, with a creation, a fallen period that we're in now, and then the eventual apokatastasis, when God is going to make everything good again. And Rabbinic Judaism and Islam have their own fairly similar sacred time stories. So there is definitely a kind of qualitative time in exoteric Abrahamic traditions. This is an example of why generalizations tend to suck. But the esoteric qualitative time, which we could describe as astrological time as a shorthand, is qualitatively different. Haha. For one thing, it's much more granular. The patterns shift from moment to moment, and it's conceived of as being, in principle, separate from human time conventions. In other words, the stars don't care if it's Sunday. They just do their thing. And events on Earth follow ineluctably, whether that's a causal thing because the stars are influencing events on Earth, or just a kind of lockstep if you are of the microcosm mirrors the macrocosm school of astrological thought. Now, I say in principle, because in practice, astrology has a pretty granular, but nevertheless quite timekeeping-based system by which astral motions can be tracked and interpreted. This is the system of the planetary week and the planetary hours, and it is the subject of this episode. I like those early Schwepp episodes and everything, but they left out some important details of how this qualitative time structure of astrology was, and sometimes still is, thought to work. It turns out the qualitative time of the ancient astrological worldview is not dead. It's nowhere near dead. In fact, it's still with us every time we name the days of the week. Have you ever noticed that the days of the week in English seem to be named after a mix of planets and gods? Weird, right? When you think about it. Why would that be the case? We'll be getting into that in this episode. But this astrological qualitative time also has a more technical side beyond the basics, which shows up not only in astrological thought proper, but in magic, in alchemy, in various divinatory arts, and even in what are sometimes called mysticisms of various stamps. In other words, you have to understand this astrological timekeeping structure to understand a lot about Western esotericism. The structure of thought, which is Hellenistic astrology at its most detailed, really doesn't make any sense without some detail-oriented knowledge. And for those who have caught the bug, once you start exploring the details, you realize it's details all the way down. And I'm no means proposing a full education in the astrological science. That's something for another podcast or two. But what we can do, and I think ought to do, as it will be very valuable for listeners, especially those who, like me, want to understand some of the history of Western esotericism but have no plans to become expert astrologers, is a crash course in some of the most important structures of qualitative time, which are presupposed by the astrological framework. So this is oddcast material, because it doesn't really fit into a time frame. Indeed, it's about time itself, and how the ancients, including ancient esotericists, measured time, or rather thought that time was measured qualitatively by nature, and how those ancient suppositions structure Western esoteric timekeeping down to the present day. The episode starts with some interesting history of the planets themselves, which we've covered mostly in the podcast already, but I thought it was good to review it. And then we're going to turn to the planetary week and the planetary hours, discussing how they work, when they arose as timekeeping models, and so on. Simple, right? We'll see. On planetary names and planetary orderings in classical antiquity. Okay, planets. Let's start from the basics. As we know, the so-called planets are called planets from the Greek planetes, meaning wanderers. Because viewed from the Earth, all the other stars seem to or appear to move in a uniform sweep across the sky, and they maintain their relative distances from each other as if they were printed onto a sphere revolving on an axis, except for the seven celestial bodies known as the planets in ancient astrology, the Sun and Moon, and Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, Venus, and Mercury. As we know, the ancient word planetes and the modern planet don't cover the same territory exactly. We consider the Sun a star and the Moon a satellite. But for the ancients, all the lights in the sky were stars, and seven of them were wandering stars or planets. All right. Now, why do we call the seven planets what we call them? And by we, I mean English speakers. The whole following discussion, be it said now, is with reference to the Anglophone world. Other languages and cultures have inherited the astral lore of antiquity in different ways. But why do we call the seven planets what we call them? Well, the seven planets are named after gods, right? Or at least those last five are. Sun and moon in English have Germanic roots, meaning, well, just what they say, sun and moon. Just as in Latin and Greek, these luminaries were known by their normal everyday names. The moon was never called Artemis, for example, except in poetry, nor was the sun known as Apollo, even though in later Greek religion, those twins were associated with those luminaries, right? The same thing goes for Latin. So sun is sol, in both everyday parlance and in technical astrology. But our other five planets are simply called by their Latin names. This is back to English now. Sometimes a bit anglicized, so Mercurius becomes Mercury, and so on. But why are our planets named after gods in the first place? That is actually not an obvious thing to do, to name your planets after gods. If we go backwards in time, we have our English names, like Saturn and Jupiter. Now, if we go back far enough, these names in English were derived from the Latin god names associated with those planets. Whatever the unlettered Anglo-Saxons of yore called the planets before they came under the Roman sort of sphere of influence, it definitely wasn't Jupiter, Saturn, etc. But at some point, some Anglo-Saxons, whom we will never know from the historical record, made the decision that we were going to call these planets by the names the Romans called them. Now, the Romans took their planetary god names from the Greeks, with the usual equivalencies which everyone's familiar with. So Jupiter is Zeus, Saturnus is Kronos, etc. But how did the Greeks decide that certain god names were to be associated with certain planets in the first place? This goes back to the Near East. The Babylonians, as we saw in episode 10, realized that the planets were different from the other lights in the night sky. And again, Babylonians here is referring to the last phase of a thousands years long project of studying the movements of the luminaries in the sky and trying eventually to mathematically model them. The Babylonian civilization of what's nowadays Iraq came the furthest in the mathematical modeling side of this and also came up with the first recognizable astrological horoscopes. But they didn't start the project, right? They realized that the planets were different from the other lights in the night sky way before the Greeks and actually thought that the planets were gods. The planet that we call Mars, they called Nergal, the war god. Not Nergal's planet or planet Nergal, world of war, although that is pretty metal, just Nergal. Now, we don't know when and where exactly the transfer of this idea of star gods to Greece happened, but we know it happened, and we know it happened sometime before the Hellenistic period, the period when Babylonia and the Near East more generally had been absorbed into the Seleucid kingdom after Alexander the Great's conquest, and you start to see a major rise in Greek-Akkadian bilingualism. That's the time you would have expected this transfer to have occurred, but it actually occurred earlier. At some time, perhaps the late 6th, but definitely by the 5th century BCE, some Greek did what that Anglo-Saxon would do centuries later. He or she looked at the planets, looked at the Babylonian god names associated with those planets, and said, I wonder what we call those gods. So Nergal, what's he about? War. Okay, right. Ares, got it. Ishtar, who's she? Oh, she's sexy. Okay, Aphrodite, great. And so on. Who's the king of your gods? Marduk. Okay, the king of our gods is Zeus. So, great, done. That's how the planets first came to be associated with specific gods in the proto-west of classical Greece. Now, we might ask, were the planets already gods among the Greeks? And they just changed the names to fit the Babylonian star gods, maybe because the Babylonian star gods were very prestigious, because the Babylonians had this well-earned prestige in astronomy. No. Before this, the Greeks had a bunch of different names for different planets, but there's nothing systematic, and there's no god names. Venus is a great and classic example. Homer already mentions her on account of her brilliant light, but the earlier names for her, or I guess for it at this stage, since she hasn't become Venus yet, include Heosphoros, Dawnbringer, and Hesperos, Duskbringer, or Dusk Star. because it wasn't clear to the Greeks that these two bright stars, visible at dawn and dusk, respectively, were in fact the same star, and that star a planet. Sometimes she's called just Phosphoros, Lightbringer. Mercury was sometimes called Hostilbon, the Twinkler, etc. But these names are descriptive. They're not standardized. They vary from place to place. And there's definitely nothing to do with gods or goddesses. Then our mysterious Greek made the Babylonian star god connection as part of a much bigger project of Greeks taking on board the generations of astronomical learning developed in the Near East. And right at that point, around the 5th century, really kicking into overdrive in the Near East in terms of advanced mathematical modeling. And these Greeks started to realize, first of all, that planets were really different from other stars, which they just hadn't known before, as far as we can tell. And secondly, that they should have god names associated with them. So from about the 3rd century BCE, we start to see more and more standardization of the names of planets. The Greeks could now more or less agree that the planet that we call Saturn was called the planet of Kronos. Actually, they called it Aster tu Kronu, the star of Kronos. And from about the 1st century BCE, we start to see the planet just called Kronos. And that will in turn become universal in pretty short order. And that, having the planets with actual god names attached to them, not even planet of or star of, but just Kronos, Hermes, etc., was taken from the Greeks by the Romans. Now, the first thing we should notice here, or flag up, is that, well, this is very striking to me anyway, is that the Greeks before, rather late in the classical period, did not worship stars. Seemingly didn't even consider them divine. In fact, one of the first times a divine panoply of stars appears in our Greek evidence is in the Orphic Lamellae, which seem to have an astral religion aspect to them, as we discussed in our Orphism episodes. There are other bits and pieces of evidence for Greeks starting to regard the stars as somehow divine, or maybe somehow having something to do with the afterlife, from the 5th century BCE, in non-Orphic contexts, in non-cultic contexts. But basically, the rather counterintuitive picture is that the stars weren't gods at first for the Greeks. The sun and moon are special cases. We do have personifications of them as far back as Homer, but for the other luminaries, nothing. Then, in rather quick succession, they learned from their Near Eastern neighbors a bunch about how the stars moved, the fact that certain special stars had god names attached to them, but weren't themselves gods. And then, from about the 1st century BCE, in a period when astrology was massively on the rise across the Eastern and Northern Mediterranean, which is not a coincidence, they started to call the planets by their god names. And lo, we start to see more and more examples of various forms of astral cult and astral worship among the Greeks and Romans. This is something we've discussed a lot in episodes of the podcast, so we won't get into it here. But there is a curious anomaly which I'd like to bring up here, just because it's vexing. Aristotle, who lived in the 4th century, had spent his time hanging out with Plato and Eudoxus of Cnidos, and with a whole bunch of other folks really interested in developing this new scientific approach to the heavens, which the Greeks were sort of running with, having got, you know, the basics from the Babylonians. Aristotle argues that the stars are indeed gods. Not just the planets, but all the stars. And one of the arguments he makes for this doctrine is the appeal to perennialism. So this is a very interesting passage in Aristotle's Metaphysics. The archaic and truly ancient peoples taught the divinity of stars, and they taught it in the form of mythos, sort of like myths, actually, religious parables, which were adapted to the primitive thinking of the common man. Although there have been catastrophes throughout history in which much knowledge has been lost, Aristotle tells us, this particular gem of wisdom, to wit, the star's divinity, has survived intact, such that Aristotle can now revive it in his Metaphysics. Now, this is weird and cool, and might lead us with Aristotle to say, well, look, clearly for our ancient ancestors with no artificial light and so on, the stars will blatantly have been godlike. So how would they not have worshipped them, right? And when we look at the well-attested astral cults in the Near East and Egypt, ancient Egypt, we can even say, look, these are the ancient peoples that Aristotle must be referring to. As we discussed in episodes 8 and 9 of the podcast, the Greeks of the classical period were well aware of the deep cultural roots their neighbors had. So when Aristotle says the most ancient peoples, he could well be referring to Egyptians and sort of Near Eastern Akkadian empires. So are we really going to say that the Greeks of earlier times had no notion that the stars were divine? Well, yes, gentle listener, that is what our evidence tells us. Now, the sun and moon, as I said, are kind of special. In book 12 of the Odyssey, Odysseus's men steal some cows, and it's a huge blunder because these are not just any cows. These are the cows of Helios, the sun god. And the moon, too, receives a bit of love here and there in our early Greek sources as a semi-personified deity. But we don't nevertheless see anything we might want to call astral cult until after the massive knowledge transfer from the Near East to Greece, starting in the late 6th or early 5th century. So counterintuitively and contra Aristotle, we really do seem to have Greeks who had no particular notions about the stars or even recognition of the fact that the planets were different from the rest of the stars until that late date. It's a curious thing. Okay, now before we turn to the planetary week, let's just linger for a moment on two crucial topics. The first is the cult of the planetary gods as planetary gods. Now, we've spoken a little bit in the podcast about a kind of elite religious mindset which grew up among intellectuals in the late Roman Republic, early Principate, and became somewhat standardized across the Roman Empire. It's often referred to by an old and very important stratum of scholarship as cosmic religion. People like Cumont, Festugier, Nielsen, great historians of ancient Greek and Roman thought, talk about this a lot. They talk about Plato, the Stoics, Cicero in the Dream of Scipio, in the De Republica, and many other intellectuals, and also talk about things like the Hermetica with all their kind of astral piety, and refer to this whole approach as cosmic religion. And this is a very important stream in Greco-Roman religion, pre-monotheist religion across the board. And it has sort of lay, folksy aspects and much more kind of intellectual, refined aspects that we see in those fancy authors like Plato. And in fact, this cosmic religion and what you might call astral religion seems to increase in importance until the final conquest by Christianity. And of course, among their many polemics against the so-called pagans, we see Christians attacking astrology, worship of stars, as one of the many errors into which the pagans fall. But on the kind of more what you might call public cult side of things, we also have a lot of evidence, which has been very well surveyed by Ilaria Boltreghini in a bunch of articles, which you can find in the bibliography to this episode, for just old-fashioned Roman, Greco-Roman cult, public cult, to the gods of the week, to, you know, the gods named in the days of the week, in that order, appearing in altars, appearing in frescoes, and depicted in various ways, listed as such, and being offered cult. You know, like, this is the cult of the gods of the week. From later in antiquity, we have prayers to the seven planets attested, as in Firmicus Maternus 1:10-14, for example. We also find this in some of the astrological texts collected in the CCAG collection, unsurprisingly. In, as we discussed in our episode on astral religious aspects in ancient Mithraism, there's a lot of astrology and just sort of astral thinking in the cult of Mithras. But it's worth pointing out here that astrology, despite all the polemics, does not die out with the rise of monotheism across the Roman realm. We won't get into it now, because we are going to get into it as the podcast progresses. But in all three Abrahamics, we find long and often tortuous relationships with the stars as intelligences, with the fact that they are at least powers to be reckoned with, if not outright gods. Sometimes they're powerful angels, sometimes they're ruhaniyat, spiritual entities. they have all kinds of different names, but we're always talking about the stars and planets. And we will find not only alchemists paying attention to the stars for obvious practical reasons, alchemical recipes in the Islamicate golden age of alchemy tend to be fully integrated with astrological considerations to one degree or another, and not to mention the notion of the planetary metals, where the metals and the planets and the days of the week all kind of correspond with each other in different ways. But practitioners of high book-learned magic are going to be attempting to use the stars to make things happen a lot as late antiquity shades into the Middle Ages and beyond. And sometimes, I don't care if you're Jewish or Christian or Muslim, sometimes doing that involved saying prayers to the stars. And there it is. The monotheisms from Judaism onwards have taken a strong esoteric stand against astrology, and they have also had strong esoteric undercurrents of astrology, and that's across the board. It's also worth mentioning that certain Westerners, not to be excluded, and here I'm referring to the inhabitants of Haran, the Sabi'a, whom we discussed in episode 191 of the podcast, Kevin von Bledel on the Sabians of Haran and the fate of the Athenian Academy. Certain groups like these Sabians, they just carried on with astral worship in a direct line from ancient Near Eastern culture, and that was their jam well into the Middle Ages. Now, those Sabi'a seem to have died out eventually, those particular ones, as a distinct group. They seem to have just gradually become Muslims. But another group of Sabi'a, the Mandeans, on whom see episode 155, still exist today, and they have a form of astral religion. But they don't worship the stars. Not because the stars aren't gods, but precisely because the stars are evil Gnostic astrological fate gods who need escaping from. But putting aside those exceptional groups, for whom astral religion of some kind was or is something of an exoteric credo, like people who just come out and say, yeah, the stars are gods, if we want to look at Western cultures more generally, we can state that astrology in various guises and with various hedges and uncomfortable problematic positionings will remain a mainstay of esoteric movements and practices, and of magic in particular, right through the Middle Ages and into modernity. Check out our interview with Michael Noble on Fakhreddin Razi as a perfect case study of an Abrahamic intellectual with impeccable Abrahamic credentials, in this case Islamic, grappling with the practicalities and theoretical problems of cosmic ascent magic, and the uncomfortable fact that this magical procedure calls on the practitioner to do all kinds of sacrifices and rather prayer-like incantations to the planetary spirits. Okay, so the importance of astrology going forward for Western esotericism is worth emphasizing. The second thing I wanted to emphasize before we get to timekeeping is a brief discussion of planetary orderings in antiquity. If you're like me, gentle listener, you will be familiar with two systems of ordering the planets from antiquity, or at least familiar enough with them that you would nod to them if you passed them in the street. These are usually referred to as the Chaldean and the Egyptian systems. And I think the reason they're known by these general names is based on Macrobius, the late antique Latin author who was the main transmitter of astral lore to Western Europe in the Middle Ages. And he describes them as such. But what does Macrobius mean by Chaldean and Egyptian? Well, the Egyptian ordering is the one implicitly followed by Plato in the Timaeus and elsewhere. It goes, starting from the furthest away from the Earth, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, Mercury, Venus, Sun, and Moon. Now, why does he call this ordering Egyptian? Well, the Egyptians for Macrobius are the privileged wise barbarians, as they were for Plato himself, and he sees their ordering of the planets as the older one, and so the one followed by Plato, who was going to the oldest source of philosophy by following the Egyptians. That's the kind of thing the great Plato would do, right? Here's the passage. On the Dream of Scipio 19, 1 to 2, in Stahl's translation. Quote, "Next, we must say a few things about the order of the spheres, a matter in which it is possible to find Cicero differing from Plato, in that he speaks of the sphere of the sun as the fourth of seven, occupying the middle position, whereas Plato says that it is just above the moon, that is, holding the sixth place from the top among the seven spheres. Cicero is in agreement with Archimedes and the Chaldean system. Plato followed the Egyptians, the authors of all branches of philosophy, who preferred to have the sun located between the moon and Mercury, even though they discovered and made known the reason why others believed that the sun was above Mercury and Venus." End of quote. So the Chaldean ordering given by Macrobius is more familiar to a lot of people. Indeed, this is the dominant ordering of the planets used in ancient astrology. And this is why Macrobius calls it Chaldean. Chaldaios was simply a synonym for astrologer in antiquity. It referred to this ethnic group from the Near East, but they had come to be synonymous with stargazing and astrology. So terms like mathematicos, astrologos, chaldaios, they all refer to what we would call an astrologer. Now, if there is one ancient planetary ordering you need to know as a student of Western esotericism, it is the Chaldean ordering. Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, the sun right in the middle, and then Venus, Mercury, and the moon. As we shall see in a moment, it's important, even if you aren't a student of Western esotericism, since it's foundational to the way we just keep time in the West. It's exoterically important, even though it comes from an esoteric source. We'll get to that. But for now, if we take the sun and the moon out of the equation, this Chaldean ordering follows the relative speeds of the planets in the sky, with Saturn moving the slowest and Mercury the fastest. And it turns out that this is also kind of right in terms of their distances. But that's kind of by accident. But the sun, moon, and Mercury have periods which average out to roughly the same value. So their positions, because you can't tell which is sort of faster and therefore which is meant to be nearer, their positions are slippery in many ancient systems. And it's worth noting here, there weren't just two systems of ordering the planets in antiquity. There were lots and lots. And while the Chaldean system gradually grew in adoption, such that authors like Cicero, as we just saw, and others like Pliny and Plutarch, will just take it for granted without needing to lay it out. They just talk about the planetary spheres or the planets, and this is the order they're assuming. It remains the case, both that many other systems coexisted with the Chaldean in antiquity, especially in cultic contexts, and that we get variants within the rough Chaldean consensus, with Mercury and Venus being known to trade places, to give the most common example. However, the adoption by Ptolemy, on whom see our Schwepp episode, in the second century is maybe what sealed the deal that the Chaldean ordering would become the ordering of the seven planets. Since medieval authorities on astrology and astronomy tended to turn to Ptolemy as the ancient authority par excellence, as we discussed in episode 88. So there's kind of a second century watershed after which the order of the planets is pretty fixed. Though I have no doubt that weird custom orderings will continue into the Middle Ages and beyond. I don't have any at my fingertips right now, but I'm sure some are going to turn up as the podcast progresses. Now, the planetary week to which we are about finally to turn is provably generated from the Chaldean ordering. So at this stage, we're going to bid a fond farewell to the Egyptian order, and indeed to all the other interesting weird variant orders from Mithraea, from the Pistis Sophia, from commentators on Virgil, from all sorts of different literary and archaeological sources from antiquity. And carry on. If you want to check out some of those alternate orderings, see the recommended reading for some sources that go into great detail on cool custom planetary orderings. For now, we need to stay with our astrological Chaldean order and turn to the aforementioned planetary week. The Origins of the Planetary Week and On the Planetary Hours. It's worth emphasizing, first of all, that we have a week and a 7-day week at that, but that isn't a law of nature. It's something that was arbitrarily decided on out of all the possible ways of organizing and subdividing the year. Seemingly, the 7-day week comes to dominate the West from two main streams of influence. The later stream that's really important is the ancient Jewish 7-day week, immortalized in the book of Genesis, where God creates the earth and the universe in 6 days, and on the 7th day he rests, and that 7th day is going to become the Jewish Sabbath day. So that really cemented the 7-day week as a God-given scenario once the Christianization of the Roman Empire got going, because they just took it over from the Jews. But the earlier source of the week, from the Greco-Roman perspective, and of our planetary week in particular, is more esoteric. I refer, of course, to astrology, and here we can be pretty specific. The ancient Mesopotamian cultures who bequeathed us the planets and the notion that they were associated with particular gods, they didn't have a week. As eminent Akkadianist and friend of the show, Daniel Schwemer, informs me, quote, "Mesopotamians generally did not have a 7-day week as a regular unit of time, and consequently there was no naming of the days of the week. The subdivision of the year is lunar, and below month level, the new moon, new light, and in particular the full moon, days 1 and 15, play a significant role in the cultic calendar. Sometimes texts further subdivide by having series of days, 1, 7, 15, 21, but without defining these periods as a 7-day week that can be counted throughout the year. The names for these important days refer to the lunar cycle, not to other celestial bodies. In the old Assyrian period, there was an administrative period called Hamushtun, 5th, which basically represents a 7-day week, but that never caught on beyond the old Assyrian period." End of quote. The ancient Greeks and Romans also didn't originally have regularized standard calendars, nor regularized week reckonings. The fact that our current calendar is still called Julian goes back to the calendrical reforms put forward by Julius Caesar in the 1st century BCE in what was an attempt to impose some kind of order on the chaos of different reckoning systems in use, the lunar ones, solar ones, different ways of reckoning when the calends and stuff like that would occur. But even by the 2nd century CE, so, you know, roughly 200 to 300 years after Caesar's intervention, when Vettius Valens, the great astrologer, was writing, he's dealing with still a whole chaos of locally popular systems for organizing time. He tends to plonk for the so-called Alexandrian reckoning, which combines Egyptian and Greek systems. But it's still the case that Caesar didn't just overwrite the whole Mediterranean with his reformed calendar, and that was the end of the story. The notion of one calendar to rule them all did eventually come to pass in different places, in different ways. The East Romans would develop a standard, legislated, from the creation of the world calendar. The Western Christian cultures eventually settled on the BC/AD system, which we still use today. Sometimes we say, like here on the podcast, BCE and CE before Common Era and Common Era, to try to pretend that we're not being religiously partisan, but we're just blatantly using a Eurocentric Western European Christian dating system and considering it a universal dating system. It's really stupid, like the arrangement of letters on a computer keyboard. You could do better, but everyone's used to it, so we don't do better. But this long, slow story of calendrical standardization was a very slow and very messy process. Meanwhile, Jews and Muslims still reckon time by the lunar cycles. The Chinese have their own thing going on. The Persians still use their traditional kind of pre-Islamic calendar. The ancient Mesoamerican civilizations had some really involved qualitative and quantitative time reckoning systems, etc., etc. However, all the cultures of the West, however they reckon months and years, share one thing: the 7-day week. So here in the West, how and when did the 7-day week arise as a dominant mode of measuring time? And how did it get planetary? This is a really interesting question to me. It seems natural to refer to Saturday. But why on earth do we associate a given day of the week with a Latin name for a god, which is also a planet? If you stop and think about it, that is not a priori what you would expect, right? And the answer, in a word, is astrology. Our evidence for the earliest Hellenistic astrology, that is what the system that most people mean when they say astrology, unless you are in India or China, the full gamut of structures making up the system of Western astrology, although many bells and whistles have been added down the ages, came out of Hellenistic era Egypt, as we know. And early in this tradition, maybe right at the beginning, we don't know for sure when this crept in, just as we can't say for sure where exactly this doctrine arose, although people throw the name Alexandria around all the time, because when you're talking about esoteric thought in ancient Egypt of the Hellenistic period, when in doubt, just say Alexandria, seems to be the rule in scholarship. At any rate, right at or near the beginning of the tradition arose the notion of chronocratores, time rulers. And this idea is hugely important to astrology. The idea that a given planet is especially dominant at a given set of times. Each chronocrator has a day which belongs to him or her, their day. And within each day, a series of planetary hours in which they are especially powerful or dominant. So there's a day of Venus, and within the day of Venus, there are also hours of Venus. That's when you get the serious Venus vibes. The hour of Mars within the day of Venus is going to combine Martial and venereal influences, and it's a bit of more of a tricky proposition. That's kind of how it works. Now, no one, again, knows exactly when this system evolved, but we see it in its full flourishing from about the first century BCE, for sure. And we still see it in how we call the days of the week, as we'll see anon. Now, in terms of when the planetary way of modeling the week took hold in a big way, sort of got off the ground and really became a standard way of doing it, Boltrighini and Stern have looked at the evidence in a really broad spectrum way, and they suggest that it happened in Italy. Our first evidence for the planetary week as a planetary week starts to show up in the second half of the first century BCE, the late Republican period, in a few literary sources, and in the first two centuries of our era, so first and second centuries CE, we see more and more evidence, including epigraphic, documentary, and most interestingly to me anyway, artistic stroke religious evidence in the form of depictions of the seven planetary gods in the order of the days of the week. There was indeed a cult of the gods of the week prevalent here and there throughout Italy and later on further abroad. So while the chronocratores as an idea came from Egypt and entered into the Greek oikumene, the full meshing of that idea with the pantheon of gods, with cult, and with the calendar seems to be a Roman phenomenon, and indeed an Italian phenomenon in its inception. The widespread popularity of astrology, both technical and folksy, in the Roman lands that we discussed in episode 61, the esoteric and the state in ancient Rome, part 2, the state and the stars, follows precisely this profile, first showing up in the first century BCE, and becoming quasi-universal by the first century CE and beyond. So our evidence for the planetary week's adoption follows this trajectory as we would expect. Once we realize that the impetus for this particular type of week is not coming from any old place, it's coming specifically from astrology. But is it really? I mean, do we need to look to astrology, this rather recondite art, for the origin of the Roman planetary week? Yes, gentle listener, we do. And the reason we do is elegant and beautiful. We noted the Chaldean ordering earlier, the one astrologers liked the most and used. Now, the days of the week don't follow the Chaldean order, as someone has already noticed listening to this. The days of the week go Chronos, Saturn, or Saturday, Helios, Sol, Sunday, Selene, Moon, Luna, Monday, Aries, Mars, Tuesday, Hermes Mercurius Wednesday, Zeus Jupiter Thursday, and Aphrodite Venus Friday. Or take your Germanic god names if you're an English speaker. So Zeus Jupiter Thursday is Thursday because it's Thor's day. Thunder gods, right? Etc. So what is this order all about, if it isn't the Chaldean order? This ordering is a direct product of the Chaldean planetary order, but you have to get there through the planetary hours. So you start with Saturn, the first planet in the Chaldean order from the Earth, furthest from the Earth. Saturday is the first day of the planetary week, and if you start counting from a different day, this won't work, but you start on Saturday. Now, each Greco-Roman day has 24 hours, but they're not hours as we know them. There are 12 hours each of day and night. So the length of an hour is going to vary depending on the time of year. To get the hour of the day, the rule is you divide whatever the time between sunrise and sunset is into 12 equal parts. So in summer, you're going to get very long hours. In winter, you're going to get very short hours. And the same thing goes for the hours of the night, right? So again, it's like planet. We have the same term used in two different ways. In this case, the hour is not an equal division of the circle of the clock into 60 minutes, but rather a expanding or contracting division based on equal chopping up into 12, but based more on the movements of the sun and moon and the earth rather than an arbitrary clock. Now, each day of the week has its ruling planet, but each hour does as well. So starting with Saturday, on hour one, this is going to be the hour of Saturn. And then you're going to proceed through the planets in the Chaldean order to figure out what planet each hour applies to. When you reach the moon, you start again at Saturn and keep going with the cycle of seven planets throughout the whole day until you reach the end of the day. And you are going to end on the sun. You repeat this process. Starting with the hour of the sun, you go through all the Chaldean planets, ascribing each to an hour in turn, and you keep cycling through until you get to the moon. Each time you end up on a different planet, and each time that planet is the planet of the familiar planetary week that we still use. So that's how you get the order of the planetary week from the Chaldean order of the astrologers. It goes back to the doctrine of the chronocratores, the time rulers, and having you start with the premises of chronocratores, 7-day week, Chaldean order of the planets, and a 24-hour cycle within a day, and you can generate the days of the week. Another way of generating the week is shown in the illustration to this episode. You write the Chaldean planets in the Chaldean order on the points of a heptagon, and then starting with Saturday, you go around the points, jumping 3 points each time. So you jump to the sun, then the moon, and so forth. And Vettius Valens, the great astrological authority of the second century, gives yet another mathematical method for deriving the days of the week from the Chaldean order and the planetary hours, but it's much more cumbrous the way he gives it, but it still arrives at the same model. The point for our purposes is that the planetary week is clearly the product of the astrological planets arranged into astrological hours. Now, the days and hours are not primarily of interest to historians of Western esotericism because they're the origin of the planetary week. I just think the planetary week is really cool. But they are of interest because time, structured in this way, becomes a densely significative web of astral qualities with crucial consequences in the occult sciences. Even casual students of astrology are familiar with the notion of kairos, the opportune time for undertaking something. Well, the planetary days and hours are the most fundamental tool for calculating kairos, for what's called catarchic astrology. You also need the zodiac situation and the conjunctions and all that sort of thing. But if you need to set off with your army, the first question you want to ask is, what's the best day? Well, that would be Tuesday, a priori, the day of Aries, and probably in the hour of Aries, the first or eighth or 15th hours, when Aries is fully in charge, right? If someone needs seducing, why not start on the day of Venus, in the hour of Venus? Now, it's not just catarchic astrology or astrological calculations in general that involve the planetary days and hours. And this is why this is system is so fundamental for Western esotericism. Magical operations may need to consult the day and hour for efficacy. The East Roman manual known as the Hygromantia of Solomon has a major section devoted to listing the days, the hours, and what is magically effective in each hour. So it's clear that this astromagical approach is derived initially from astrology, but it has its own specifically magical concerns. And then once you get angels, ranks of angels, and sometimes even demons involved in it, so not only will each planetary hour be planetary, it might also have a demon and an angel associated with it, as in this Solomonic text, then you're getting into some serious magical knowledge. And this sort of material goes on into the medieval Arabic, Jewish, and even Latin traditions of learned magic, where it becomes a central way of organizing time and magical praxis. In terms of alchemy, as we move forward, although we did see some astrological concerns coming up in the great Zosimus of Panopolis writing in late antiquity in Egypt, astrological concerns become integral to the kind of holistic occult science alchemy that we find in the Middle Ages, and we're going to be seeing a lot of astrology in studying medieval and later alchemy. I hope this little exposé has been helpful and interesting. I find the fact that there's sort of a very, very esoteric doctrine hiding in plain sight in the way we talk about the week to be a fascinating cultural artifact. And it's worth talking about, if only to demonstrate, if any demonstration were needed, that the history of Western esotericism is often the history of culture more generally, right? Until next time, be like the astrological mechanics hiding in plain sight in the names of the days of the week, and stay esoteric.